Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Indian officials recently approved weight guidelines for children's school bags. The central government said the weight of the bag should depend on the age of the child. It urged all Indian states to set limits in accordance with the new guidance. Indian officials have denounced schools for making students carry heavy school bags and giving young children homework. Under the guidelines, no homework would be given to children in classes 1 and 2. This will ensure that the youngest students have no books to carry home. For students in classes 3 to 5, the weight of a school bag would never be more than 3 kilograms. And bags would never weigh more than 5 kilograms for students in class 10. The Indian government noted studies that show how a heavy load can affect students' soft and developing spines. One study by the Associated Chambers of Commerce and Industry of India found that 68% of young children might suffer from mild back pain. The mild pain can develop into long-term back pain and affect bones of the spinal column. The study involved more than 2,500 children between the ages of 7 and 13. It found that more than 88% of children carried more than 45% of their body weight on their backs. Rashmi Tapki is a mother of 2 children in Mumbai. She said, "Heavy school bags reflect poor planning." She supports the federal weight limits. She added, "If they plan, they can repeat the subjects taught and thus reduce the load. My kids find it difficult to carry so many books." Mumbai is the capital of the Indian state of Maharashtra. The state requires that a school bag's weight should be no more than 10% of a child's body weight. Many schools there have started using whiteboards and projectors in classes. This has reduced the number of books to be carried to school. But in large parts of rural India, children still have to walk great distances weighed down by heavy school bags. Rajendra Shukla's daughter attends school in Uttar Pradesh state. He said she has to bring about 4 to 5 kilograms of books in her school bag and also carry her lunchbox and water bottle in a separate bag.
Most people would do anything to get out of jail. Some prisoners risk their lives in attempts to escape and regain their freedom. But some South Koreans actually pay money to spend time in a mock jail to escape the pressures of daily life. The detention center, called Prison Inside Me, opened in the South Korean city of Hongchun in 2013. Since then, more than 2,000 people have put themselves through the prison-like experience. Many of them are tired, overworked office workers or students. Some say the complete isolation of a jail environment can help them break free from day-to-day pressures. The building looks like a real prison. Inside, individuals are kept alone in small cells. There is no bed in the room, so many sleep on the floor on a yoga mat. These prisoners receive only a blue uniform to wear, a tea set, as well as a pen and paper for keeping notes. Prison rules are strongly enforced. Electronic devices, clocks, and other personal belongings are banned. Talking among the prisoners is not permitted. Food served is simple. It includes rice porridge in the morning and steamed sweet potato and a banana drink for dinner. Pak He Ni is a 28-year-old office worker. She paid $90 to spend 24 hours at the prison inside me. She says the experience gave her a sense of freedom that she really needed. "I was too busy," Pak told the Reuters news agency as she sat in her 55-square-meter cell. "I shouldn't be here right now, given the work I need to do. But I decided to pause and look back at myself for a better life." No Ji Hung is one of the founders of the mock prison. She told Reuters she got the idea from her husband, a government lawyer who often put in 100-hour work weeks. She said her husband once told her he would like to take a break from work and go into solitary confinement for a week to rest and feel better. No said that some people are not sure what to expect when they first arrive to take part in the unusual prison experience. But after they stay, they say this isn't a prison. "The real prison is the life they return to," she said. South Korea is known for its demanding work culture and schooling. The suicide rate is 2 times as high as the United States and one of the highest in the world. An international study showed that on average, South Koreans worked 2,024 hours in 2017. This was the third longest after Mexico and Costa Rica, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development reported. Experts say a downturn in recent years in South Korea's export-driven economy has made employment and school competition more intense. This could lead even more people to temporarily escape real life in a prison-like environment. I'm Brian Lin.
A Chinese researcher's claim of creating the world's first genetically edited babies is considered irresponsible by many scientists. The researcher's employer, Southern University of Science and Technology of China, said it did not know about the activities. China's government ordered a halt to the work on Thursday. The researcher, He Jianque, said he had edited the genetic material, or DNA, of two girls born recently. He said he had performed the gene editing to help protect the babies from infection with HIV, the virus responsible for the disease AIDS. He said the process had worked safely and the two girls were as healthy as any other babies. There has been no independent confirmation of He's work, and he did not provide written documentation of his research. On Wednesday, He defended his work at an international conference in Hong Kong. He also announced a possible second pregnancy using the same process. Scientists have been quick to condemn the experiments. David Baltimore is with the California Institute of Technology and a leader of the conference. He received the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1975. He called the experiment irresponsible. Baltimore said it did not meet the guidelines many scientists have agreed on before gene editing could be considered. Jennifer Doudna is a University of California, Berkeley scientist and one of the inventors of the CRISPR gene editing tool used in the experiment. She called it truly unacceptable. She told the Associated Press, "I don't think that we heard answers. We still need to understand the motivation for this." "I feel more disturbed now," said David Liu of Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Broad Institute. He is the inventor of a version of the gene editing tool. Liu said the experiment is an example of what not to do about a promising technology. He said he hopes that it never happens again. In China, Vice Minister of Science and Technology Xu Nanping said the experiment crossed the line of morality and ethics adhered to by the academic community and was shocking and unacceptable. In 2017, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine released a report about human gene editing. The group said gene editing should be used for research only in a laboratory to learn how to change embryos. The academies also said the measure is not ready for human pregnancies, and if it is ever permitted, it should be used to treat or prevent serious diseases with no better choices available. Federal money cannot be used for gene editing of human embryos in the United States. Other countries also have restrictions. People who oppose such experiments say changes to a person's DNA can pass to future generations. They say gene editing risks harming other genes and affects people who did not accept the treatment. Others fear that the experiment will lead rich parents to seek genetic improvement to produce what are called designer babies. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. Thank you.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document had established a loose union of the 13 states with a weak central government. But instead of amending the Articles, the delegates at the convention wrote a completely new constitution. As we heard last time, one of the issues they discussed was slavery. The existence of slavery affected decisions like how to count the national population. It also affected the powers proposed for Congress. The delegates at the convention accepted several political compromises on the issue of slavery. One compromise was the three-fifths rule. The population would be counted every 10 years to decide how many members each state would have in the House of Representatives in Congress. With the three-fifths rule, the delegates agreed that every five slaves would be counted as three people. Another compromise would allow states to import slaves until the year 1808. After that, no new slaves would be brought into the country. Many of the delegates in Philadelphia did not like these compromises, but they knew the compromises would keep the southern states, where slavery was most widespread, from leaving the convention. After all the debates, bitter arguments, and compromises, the delegates were nearing the end of their work. 4 months had passed since the convention began. The weather had been hot. Emotions had been hot too, but that was expected. After all, the men in Philadelphia, and the delegates were all men, were deciding the future of their country. Early in September, the convention appointed five delegates to a committee of style. It was their job to write the document containing all the decisions made at the convention. The chairman of the committee was William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut. The other members were Alexander Hamilton of New York, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, Rufus King of Massachusetts, and James Madison of Virginia. Of these five men, Governor Morris was known for the beauty of his language. So Johnson asked him to write the Constitution. Here in Washington, visitors to the National Archives can read an original copy of the United States Constitution. Leanne Potter at the National Archives says visitors are often surprised that the document is only 4 pages long.
The irony is that the pages are actually nearly 3 feet long and about 2 feet wide. They're written on parchment. In other words, they're written on animal skin using an iron gall ink. And this particular document was created in September of 1787.
The convention approved 23 articles for the Constitution. Governor Morris rewrote them in simpler form, so there were just 7.
The document itself is divided by article, and each article focuses on a different aspect of the American government.
Article 1 describes the powers of the Congress. It explains how to count the population for purposes of representation. and it states who can become senators or representatives and how long they can serve. Article 2 describes the powers of the president. It explains the requirements for the office and how the president is to be elected. Article 3 describes the powers of the federal judiciary, which includes the Supreme Court and all of the district and circuit courts. Leanne Potter at the National Archives explains.
That part of our government makes sure that the laws that the legislative branch creates and are being enforced by the executive branch are in fact constitutional. In other words, that the laws they create are legal themselves.
The first three articles provide a system of checks and balances. The purpose is to prevent any of the three branches of government, legislative, executive, or judicial, from becoming too powerful. Article 4 explains the rights and duties of the states under the new central government. Article 5 provides a system for amending the Constitution. Article 6 declares the Constitution to be the highest law of the land. And Article 7 simply says the Constitution will be established when 9 states approve it. The members of the convention wrote a preamble for the Constitution. It began, "We, the undersigned delegates of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and so on," it listed all 13 states by name. The Committee of Style did not think it was a good idea to list each state. After all, Rhode Island never sent a delegate to Philadelphia. And no one knew for sure if every state would approve the Constitution. So Gouverneur Morris wrote instead, "We, the people of the United States of America." Those simple words solved the problem. But they caused angry debate during the fight to approve the Constitution. They made clear that the power of the central government came not from the states, but directly from the citizens of the nation. Modern-day Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas came from a family descended from slaves. He grew up in the southern state of Georgia. Justice Thomas recalled having to memorize the opening statement to the Constitution when he was a child.
I always think it's so fascinating to think of these black kids in the segregated school in Savannah reciting the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. What do we believe? I mean, everything so obviously in front of you is wrong. You can't go to the public library. You can't live in certain neighborhoods. You can't go to certain schools. But despite all of that, you lived in an environment of people who said it was still our birthright to be included.
The rest of the preamble states why the Constitution was written. In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The next step was to sign the document. On September 17th, the delegates gathered for the last time. One might think all of their business finally was done. But Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts rose to speak. "If it was not too late," he said, "he would like to make a change." Instead of electing one representative for every 40,000 people, as agreed, he suggested changing the number to 30,000. Gorham's proposal could have caused a bitter argument. Then, suddenly, George Washington, the president of the convention, stood up. The delegates were surprised. He had said little all summer. Now George Washington rose to express his support for the proposed change. He said it would guarantee a greater voice in the government for the people of the nation. Every delegate agreed to the change, which would mean a larger number of representatives in Congress. Finally, it was time to sign the Constitution. It was also the last chance to speak against it. Many delegates stated their objections to different parts of the document. In the end, most of the delegates declared that for the good of the nation, they would sign it. Several, however, refused to put their name on the Constitution. Edmund Randolph of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts said they could not sign the document. They believed it would not be approved by the states. And that, Gerry said, would lead to civil war. George Mason of Virginia also refused to sign. He had several reasons, but his first objection was that the document did not guarantee enough liberties. There is no declaration of any kind for preserving the liberty of the press, or the trial by jury in civil causes, nor against the danger of standing armies in time of peace. Mason wanted to add a Declaration of Rights. Randolph, Gerry, and Mason were the only delegates present in Philadelphia who did not sign the Constitution. Four other delegates who opposed it went home before the signing. So did nine delegates who supported the Constitution but went home early. Few of the delegates in Philadelphia could feel sure that enough states would approve the Constitution to make it the law of the land. As several of them said later, they wrote it the best they could. Without it, the young nation would break apart before it even had a chance to succeed. If future generations did not like the Constitution, it offered ways for them to change it. Here is George Washington, played by an actor.
I'm a practical man. I hope for the best, but I plan for the worst. And that's what this document does.
A record of the convention said that as the last delegates were signing the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin looked toward the president's chair. There was a sun painted on the back of the chair at the top. Franklin observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to make a rising sun look different from a setting sun. Franklin said he had looked often at the sun on the chair during the convention without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, he said, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.